Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
That was master of mirth and inveterate storyteller Brian Brown, who created the Brown Briefly. Together we, the Brieflies, strive with dogged determination to keep Brian's creative flame alive by bringing to you every week another episode of intelligent discussion of current events laced with humor and empathy. So let's get started by introducing the briefies. I need to get back into practice here, gentlemen.
So we're not sitting around in our underwear, so let's just clarify
okay,
that.
Okay, all right. Okay, so just to be clear.
Thank God.
I'll second that emotion. So first of all, it goes without saying, former Alaska Airlines airline pilot and hopefully soon to be re-elected Vachon Airport Commissioner. Can I say that with our FCC?
Sure.
Truman O'Brien again has his hands on the dials, buttons, and knobs of the control panel in Voice of Vachon's Gene Bosch broadcast studio in bustling, bodacious downtown Vachon. And I actually have the privilege of looking over Truman's left shoulder to see how it really works.
See the magic at work. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, thanks. I'm here.
Yeah, excellent. Good to be here with you. Let's see, our own globe-trotting guardian of the galaxy, historian extraordinaire, skipper of the Vashona, and president of the Vachon Heritage Museum, Bruce Hallman, is here. Good day, Bruce.
Good morning. It's good to be here this morning.
Likewise. Joining Truman, as always, in the studio, along with the other Brieflies today, is Truman's wingmate, airplane co-owner, exceptionally bright Fulbright scholar, and a former high-fashion shoe salesman, as well as a former Washington State Assistant Attorney General. Craig Bellis is here. How are you this morning, Craig?
I'm good. I'm thrilled to see you, Kevin, and Bruce here in the studio with us. It's great to have the four Brieflies all together.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All in one place. That sometimes could be dangerous. let's see. If you haven't picked up on it already, I am Kevin Jones, the anointed Quartermaster Yacht Club Tech Talk Wizard, and sometimes too often heard voice of Indivisible Vachon and the Vachon Climate Action Group, still striving to create a livable planet overseen by a government we can call all appreciate or at least tolerate. And today, in helping us with that government that we can appreciate, we welcome Washington State Senator Joe Wynn to the show. Senator Wynn, to borrow a line from a former vice presidential candidate, can we call you Joe?
That's no problem at all.
Fantastic. And it is so wonderful to have an opportunity to have you join us today.
No, thank you so much for having me. I love coming on the show.
Fantastic. Well, as you probably well know, and the Brieflies certainly do, before we dive into talking about a livable planet, let's take a moment to check in with everyone about what special things you experienced this last week. But first, which Briefly is on indictment watch today? Is somebody monitoring?
Normally, we have it on the screen over here, and
I can do that.
So we can moderate that. We're not moderate. We can
monitor.
Monitor. Yes. It begins with an M. I knew that.
Yeah, we know our listener wants to devote their full attention to the Brown Briefly and not be distracted by having to look for the next indictment news flash. So that's a service we provide here. Let's see, Bruce. How's things been going with you?
Been going well. This week, I just got back on Sunday from taking the grandkids for a cruise around Central Sound. A lot of people head north or down to South Sound. We just did a cruise to Paulsbow and Bainbridge and Blake Island and Bremerton, you know, just the local sort of area around Vachon. And it was great. And, of course, beautiful weather. And then on Thursday, I actually have the honor of taking a group of from the senior center out on Vachona for a tour of Quartermaster Harbor. So a boating week, if you will.
Nice. Perfect month for that. All right. Truman, now that you've got our monitoring for the indictment watch up and running, what else have you been doing this week?
Well, I was wearing one of my hats that you mentioned that is airport commissioner. I've had a number of things going on there, a special meeting and a whole bunch of stuff. So Nothing that we need to get into, but I've been really busy with all of that. So there you go.
All right. Busy can be good.
Indeed.
Okay. Craig, how's your week been?
My weekend was fabulous. I had a great time this weekend. I started out a little rocky, taking the camper that we have, this pop-up camper that goes on the back of the truck. And because we left the remote control for the pop-up top outside too long, it totally corroded the only way you can raise and lower the roof. Mm-hmm. So I had to hot wire the roof. And I just figured out how to do it about 8 o'clock before at night, before the morning we were going to take off for Crescent City to visit our son and our daughter and our son-in-law and our granddaughter, all of whom rent a place down in outside of Crescent City, a campground. And it was fantastic. We went rafting in rubber, collapsible kayaks down the Smith River amongst the giant redwoods in absolutely gorgeous weather. So I had a tremendous, terrific time. And we drove back up the Oregon coast, a little 9 hours, got back last night about 8 o'clock. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no kidding. All right. Hey, I'm wondering if vintage car ownership gives you particular credentials to hotwire a pop-up camper.
It helps if you know how to hotwire things, yes.
Yeah, okay. Very good. Particularly
if you own an English antique
right.
car.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, I hear the British are famous for those, yes, electrical, yeah, systems. Yeah. Joe, I would like to hear from you. How has your week been going?
Oh, it's good. I have vintage motorcycles, so I don't have vintage cars. Mine's a BMW, so I was able to start just fine. I haven't had to hotwire it. But the highlight probably was hanging out with my kids. We took them rock climbing for the first time ever out by Exit 38 off of I-90, and it just was an absolute blast. So sharing the outdoors with my kids is kind of a new passion that we have in our household.
Great.
Nice. So you're out there top roped and doing some climbs.
Yes.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Hey, Joe, how old are your kids?
4, 6, and 8.
Oh boy.
Oh boy.
Yeah, having little kids is a great prep for working with legislators, I will say.
all good training. Well, I had also the good fortune to spend some time in the outdoors. A couple of buddies and I went up Tunnel Creek and to Valhalla Peak, which is just at the bend in the road on off of 50-50 Pass. And one of the fantastic things about that trail is, and from Valhalla Peak, you look right at Mount Constance, which is a tremendous cliff face, which can be climbed, but so far I've declined that offer. But I also, Joe, just to mention you and your kids doing some climbing, I went by the Mountaineers, of which I'm a former member, and there had to have been 30 under 15, 16-year-olds involved in climbing and bouldering and other classes there. So the Mountaineers is doing a great job of reaching out to young people about our environment and the great outdoors, which is, of course, something we're going to be talking about today. Let's see. And just so everybody knows, today we have kind of an interesting trifecta of national days. It's National Happiness Happens Day today. It's also National Sneak Some Zucchini Onto Your Neighbor's Porch Day. And today is also National CBD Day. So, you might put all those together and have a good time today.
That does remind me, you need to lock your car so you don't get those zucchinis left in your automobile.
Well, as our friend that played at our hangar the other day said, they call it being zooked.
That's right.
All right. I so far have avoided that, but I live at the end of a dirt road.
There you go.
You're an end of the roader.
I am. I am an end of the roader. You can tell if you look at the back of my car. I bring the road with me wherever I go. Mm. Let's dive right into small talk. A recent government Inslee press update claimed that Washington State is, I will quote, building a landmark climate laws that put the state closer to achieving its energy needs and create more jobs while ebbing the tide of climate change, unquote. Leading that work from the Senate is Environment, Energy, and Technology Committee Chair Joe Wynn. So thank you, Joe, for joining us today.
No, thank you for having me. I get to work with him a lot. So we partner on a number of policies.
Fantastic. Well, we'd love to hear more about what you're working on. But first, new job for you this session as the chair of that Senate Energy, Environment, and Technology Committee. So how did that go?
It is a lot of fun. You know what's funny? The biggest shift was when you go from being a rank and file member, you beg for attention, you beg for policies, you beg for funding. And then it's the exact opposite. Now you're the one that's kind of, you know, being the guy, showing where things are. Probably the best part about being chair is that you set the tone and you set the pace. And as you can imagine, Kevin, you've seen me over the past few years. I don't go slow. So we kind of just ram things through, got a lot of things done. We're able to accomplish a significant number of policies as well. So I think that's probably the key difference is instead of trying to get other folks to do work, you set the tone and you go. And people have to keep up or else they get left behind. So that's kind of the biggest difference, I think, from being a chair versus just before.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of accomplishments, so what do you see as the most memorable accomplishment this last session from your work in that committee?
Oh, CCA spending, for sure. I think that's probably one of the bigger points. The interesting thing is that we passed the Climate Commitment Act before the investment, the Inflation Reduction Act at the federal level. And in fact, parts of the IRA is based off of what we did in Washington State. So the CCA is part of what we were talking about once it got to the federal level. So being able to take these climate policies and make these investments in deep decarbonization, I thought was incredibly important. For us to reach our climate goals, that means we have to basically double the energy production that we have in Washington State that's electric over the next 25 years, which means we need to have more energy facilities, we need to have more transmission lines, and we had a number of policies that kind of got into the nuts and bolts for us to actually transition to a clean economy as well, as well as a whole host of other things, just to kind of make sure that we're protecting our environment, that we're protecting the policies that we put into place, and that we're going to hold, you know, some of these companies accountable for their pollution. And the biggest part for me is defending the policies that we have in Washington State, which is best in the nation.
And you mentioned CCA, the Climate Commitment Act. And if I understand right, that is where polluting industries are now required to pay a certain amount of money based on their carbon pollution. And then those investments go towards carbon reduction investments.
Yeah, exactly. Right? So it's a bit more nuanced, right? So the idea is that we are requiring that they decarbonize. So if they actually decarbonize, then they won't have to pay anything. If they continue to pollute, then they have to be a cost associated with it. Because to be clear, Washington State's already paying for pollution. We basically cover the costs, whether it's health costs, whether it's cleanups, whether it's things like that, where now if we put a cap on how much they can emit. And if they meet those goals, everybody wins. If they choose not to, and if they don't necessarily make those investments, then there's an accountability mechanism to hold them accountable to their decarbonization strategies as well.
Fantastic. Well, speaking of companies that continue to emit, Senate Bill 5582, supporting Washington's clean energy economy and transitioning to a clean, affordable, and reliable energy future, is the title of the bill. You know it well. It would have curtailed new natural gas hookups by Puget Sound Energy and required them to decarbonize their gas business. You sponsored that bill and introduced it in your committee, but it was not able to make it out of committee. Could you tell us what
it
happened
did,
and what do you expect?
It did. Yeah. So it was a companion bill. There was a House bill and there was a Senate bill. Mm-hmm. So early on, we decided that it was going to be a House vehicle. So that one passed the House. And then it went through my committee, passed my committee, and then sat in rules. And the reason why it sat in rules was because there was a number of concerns that people had about the policy. And a lot of it was, candidly, it's a big piece of policy in its very first year. And right now, I think the oil companies are really revving up their misinformation campaigns. And they're spending a lot of money on lobbyists to basically delay climate policies. So what I will say is that delay is the new climate denial. Most of these companies understand that climate denial doesn't really work, especially in Washington State. I will give kudos to Puget Sound Energy because they are the ones that came up with the bill. They're the ones that saw the writing on the wall and said, hey, we are going to have to decarbonize. We need the mechanisms for us to do so. If you could put a framework in place, we can hit these targets. So I actually was shocked. When the bill idea first came to me from Puget Sound Energy, I was very skeptical, as I generally would be of oil and gas companies. But I was surprised to see that they were proactive on this. And essentially what the bill would have done was put a path for the largest utility, which is Puget Sound Energy, to effectively remove gas from their portfolio. And that would have meant basically decarbonizing in a very, very significant way. And it got closer than you would have thought for something that was so contentious. But yeah, it's one of those things where I think it wasn't Puget Sound Energy that was a problem. All the folks who saw themselves, if this passed and Puget Sound Energy proved that you can actually decarbonize and get off of gas, they know they're going to have to do it. They're the ones that fought that policy so hard. Mm-hmm. But we're going to bring it back. I think we're going to have a different approach for next year, phasing in a little bit. But then a lot of that work is kind of in the works already. So I don't want to go too deep, but that's an important policy that I think we'll have to bring back.
All right. Well, I much appreciate you correcting the record of my misunderstanding of how that bill progressed. So thank you for that.
I have nightmares about that bill still. So I know all the nuances associated with it.
Yes, I can fully appreciate that. Yeah, Bruce.
Hey, Joe, I have a question about you talked earlier about, you know, charging ahead and leaving people behind. In legislation like this, what do you do to keep those who are left behind engaged? Because we can't do it all by ourselves, right?
When I say left behind, I mean legislators. I don't necessarily mean community members or advocates or things like that. And Kevin's been down to Olympia before. People have different styles. I would candidly say that the bar for legislators could be higher. I would expect my colleagues who are there to work a bit more in the off session, maybe during the session itself as well. So when I say left behind, it's not like we're going so fast that they can't keep up. It's, hey, if you didn't read your email, I'm not going to wait for you to have a hearing. Oftentimes people will ask me to move something that I've already scheduled on my hearing calendar. Not often, sometimes they'll ask to move something on my hearing calendar to a later date, so that way they can have more time to work on a policy that they could have done probably last week. It's not my problem, candidly, to manage their schedule. We have a process by which we run. I'm very transparent about how I run things. I'm very transparent about the time that we have as well. And the legislative process is very strict. If you don't do something at that date, the bill is dead. So for me, it was, I set a deadline, I set an expectation. You got to meet it. If you don't, then you don't. So that's kind of more what it is. Hmm. Same thing like having kids, just like I mentioned before.
All right. Well, hey, Joe, you're also very familiar that the Vashon Mori Environment and Climate Agenda included a plastic pollution reduction bill, a bill to include climate planning in the Growth Management Act, and both of those passed. So thank you, of course, for your efforts.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the WRAP Act, which would make producers financially liable for their packaging, a right to repair bill, which would require product developers to make product repair info available to consumers, and two bills regarding community solar, which are also on our agenda, those did not pass. Just curious, what needs to happen, do you think, to increase the likelihood of getting those bills through here in 2024?
Yeah, first off, the first two bills that you mentioned were a multi-year effort. So a lot of times bills don't pass on the first try, especially when they're pretty meaty. So even just making sure that it's prioritized. And what I will say is oftentimes when things don't pass, it's a matter of prioritization. So as context for the folks who are listening, we see about 2,000 or 3,000 bills in any given year, but we only pass 200 to 300 bills. So less than 10% of the bills we actually see that we pass. So you have to prioritize which bills come out, and you have to make sure that the ones that are coming out are the ones that have the most impact when it comes to people in Washington state. So it has to get ranked within those lenses. That's the first one. The WRAP Act, I think, is a big priority. That's a huge environmental policy that we are kind of fighting on right now. And that's basically allowing for us to have a higher rate of recycling and making sure that producers themselves are a part of that process. We have a unique situation in Washington state where we don't have a bottling system versus California, Oregon that they do. So their model, which they've been able to pass, was functionally building upon what they had before. We basically have to start from scratch. And it's a very complex process, as you can imagine. Local and smaller jurisdictions oftentimes don't even have recycling. So we're going to have to start up very new programs in very rural areas that don't have the resources to do it. And then also, you know, some people, the haulers, they get paid based off of how much they haul. So sometimes there's an incentive for them not to actually recycle. So there's a very tricky dynamic in that space. And unfortunately, it kind of got caught up in politics with some of the work that was being done on it. That's something that's going to come back for sure next year. It's a very meaty bill. The people that worked on it last year were top notch. It got as far as it about that it could. But I think that there's some work there. And then on the right to repair bill, that's a bit more straightforward. we didn't have the votes out of the Senate. One of our members happens, this is all public, you can watch on TVW, is a former executive at Apple, and they were not supportive of the bill, and that's what happened. But I will say the success of that bill is more lasting than you would actually think. When this was first introduced, I think 5 years ago, Apple and other companies had zero repair legislation. They had zero repair policies within their programs. Because of this bill and other efforts similar to it, Apple has now a program by which you can actually get the schematics and change. You can become a certified repair service and then do that as well. And it's all free. And one of the things that they started doing, and the reason why, candidly, I think that they're opposed to the RATS repair bill, is they are now moving away from mining precious materials. There's enough Apple products out there in the world where if they are able to recycle it themselves, they can use that material to build new devices. So that's part of the process that they have right now, is that they don't plan on mining any more precious materials. They just want to recycle all of them that they have and then be able to make new ones. That's why they pay you so much money to buy your phone back.
Nice.
Yeah, just as a context. And then did you have a question on community solar as well? I don't want to miss that one.
As a matter of fact, why don't we broach that by asking Truman to comment about his response to the current current community solar provisions in the state.
One of the things, I am a commissioner for our local airport. We're a it's King County Airport District number one. We have three commissioners, and on the airport we have more than 40 hangars, and they're all oriented east and west, so that the broad side or the large side of the roof is facing south. And we would like to see what the possibilities are of going solar, adding solar panels to the whole airport, and generating power that we can put back into the grid. Now, I understand that that there was a program, a state program, that did pay to help offset the cost of that. And I understand that program is no longer in use.
Oh, no, that's not true.
Oh, well, please tell me. tell me about it.
First off, let's tell me more about that project. I'd love to help figure out how to make that work. There was a legacy program that was started about 10 years ago. That money has dried up. So in 2022, we re-upped it. We created a new program through the Washington State University Energy Program, where basically we allocated $100 million for community solar. Pretty substantial amount of money for community solar that's in place right now. The two bills that you mentioned that didn't pass, those are more net metering bills than they are community solar. That's a separate kind of discussion that we can have. But for what you're describing, I think that's actually a fantastic opportunity. So in this fiscal year, I think we allocated $300,000 just to kind of get that process going again and opening up applications. In the next biennium, I think we're allocating about $25 million to kind of get it going. But overall, we have about $100 million authorized for community solar in low-income areas and PUDs and things like that. So there will be some sort of stipulations associated with it. And then right now, you can actually spend, I think, up to $2 million for nonprofit organizations that want to do basically to do community solar as well. So I think that there's a huge opportunity for us to make something work on Vashon. I personally have this vision of Vashon being kind of this energy island, an incubator for clean energy and renewable and industrial symbiosis. And I think that we should test out like those types of innovative strategies on Vashon. So that's one thing. If we want to be able to help fund capital costs for net metering, there's two separate things, for community solar on Vashon, let's figure it out. I think that there's a big pot of money that's already there that we can have access to. The other ones on net metering is much more contentious. So we can dive into that or pick a different topic, but community solar, we can help pay for that.
Well, I do think that, for example, net metering, if I understand it, is when somebody puts solar capability on their property and they generate more power than they use, net metering would allow them to actually get financial compensation for that power that they don't consume. And I think that's another area where Truman would be concerned.
Because I think we could produce way more power than we would ever use. The hangars, basically all they have are, many of them have electric motors or that drive hydraulic motors that lift their doors. They have lights, they have air compressors, and that's about it in terms of energy use. And so the amount of energy that the airport uses would be, I think, much less than what it could generate. So we would be most interested in that.
But the tricky part about net metering is that oftentimes it's not an equitable system as it could be. That's always been the argument. California is kind of going through this fight right now where they basically removed some of their net metering provisions, because what they found was that oftentimes the folks who were generating the electricity were basically offloading some of that cost to lower income communities, right? So the way that net metering works is that if you generate more electricity, the utilities would have to buy it back at the retail rate, right? So usually what happens is that if you're a utility, you buy energy at a wholesale cost, you then sell it at a retail rate, and then that margin is how they pay for their infrastructure, is how they service their customers and all that stuff.
Sure.
So if you're at a point where you're generating more electricity than you can consume, it's probably safe to say that it's not a high demand time. Right. So when they're required to buy it at a retail cost and then effectively just eat that cost because they don't have anywhere else to send it, it's just an extra cost. So you're basically socializing that cost across some of the ratepayers themselves as well. I think more advantageous and less controversial option is if we helped fund batteries, battery storage for the energy that you're producing as well. So not only you're going to pay for the energy that you're going to have the consumption of the energy that you're using, you can store some of that and then send some of that stuff back to the grid and then get it going again. Net metering, I think, is going to be a fight going forward, because inherently the more distributed solar that you'll have, the more excess energy that they're going to have to send back to the grid at a time when you don't actually need to use that energy. I think microgrids and then community solar with battery is a more viable option.
Well, you know, for us, I mean, it really is. I mean, it doesn't, we don't really need to sell the energy back, but if we can just put more energy back into the grid than we're using, I think that would be a benefit to the community as in general, don't you think? I mean,
yeah, that's why the microgrid would be awesome as well. Mm-hmm. So that way the energy that you're producing, so community solar shouldn't just be for those hangers. If there's an interconnection, so the way that energy works is that if there's like a transmission line that's nearby, there's a way to interconnect with the microgrid that's local, that would be ideal. Does that make sense? So like if you have like a storage facility of batteries on Vashon that's connected to a bunch of the homes or businesses on Vashon, and as you create energy, that can then be used at all the other businesses as well. So even if they don't have solar on their roof, the electrons from your solar panels can get there.
Sure.
So you could actually make Vashon more, you know, more energy independent and probably be cheaper as well.
And in fact, I just learned recently that one of our neighbors that's right next door to the airport is completely off the grid now with his own solar system. And so I don't know if there's some way to, you know, make all that work together. That would be fantastic.
They have a battery. They probably use a 12-volt. I'm not sure how big the house is. I would guess it's a battery.
Yeah, I would guess. Yeah.
Well, definitely more on that topic to come. There's quite a bit of interest on Vashon. Truman is just one of a few people that I've talked to who have these kind of questions. So thank you for illuminating that.
Let me just ask real quickly, is there some way to apply for this, some of this funding?
You go to Washington State Energy Program and just look up community solar, you'll see it. And the application period is open right now. There's four, I think, that's already kind of in the progress. And I think Vashon would make a very strong case to be part of that cohort as well.
Okay. So it's a Washington State Energy. What was the last?
Washington State Energy Program.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, they're great. They do awesome work.
Great.
Truman's
thank you very much.
Probably going to get on the internet right now and check that out.
I'm going to look at that, in fact.
You're absolutely
right.
That's how you know, your senator will listen and respond, and we'll do it live on the radio.
Yeah, absolutely. I love it.
Hey, Bruce, I think you had a question about our transportation lifeline.
Well, we live on an island. We're dependent on ferries. What role does the environmental community play with the ferry system? Could you talk a little bit about that, and then just general what you see, how the legislature is setting up to sort of resolve the issues with the Washington State ferry system?
Yeah. So one of the first things I did when I got there was help fund 5 new ferry boats. The sad part was that we had a hiccup with kind of our main provider at that time, and that contract was never executed. So it was weird, because even if there was the resources to pay for these boats, obviously there's a whole host of other things that have to come to play. So from the, you know, capital and maintenance side, we did a pretty significant thing last year where we actually waived the requirement that boats have to be made in Washington State. So historically in Washington State, you had to build boats here. We basically said, we're going to open it up. And if the best bid isn't from Washington State, the next five boats or whatever number of boats that we actually funded can be made anywhere. They'll still be in the United States. So likely it'll be probably in the Gulf region where they do a lot of these types of works. But that'll get the cost down, I think, significantly, but also increase it as well. And the idea is that potentially there can even be a joint venture where they use the same engineering designs and schematics and they build them at two facilities versus having to wait for them to build one and then build another one as well. So that's probably the biggest one. I see that your hand is up. Feel free to ask a question before I jump to the next one.
Yeah, just quickly. I have recently had lunch with a marine engineer who designs, in fact, he designed some of our ferry boats. And his comment was that when you build boats outside of the Pacific Northwest, that you have to get them here. And that these boats are not made for ocean, you know, transport. And so that's a major deal. If you have them made in the Gulf Coast, getting them here, it gets to be a huge cost and problem. So what, do you have any comments about that or?
Yeah, airplanes are the same way. So not the entire fuselage for airplanes are not necessarily the same way. You can piece them together and have certain sections be built and then compiled here. Even the boats that we have right now, we're kind of done that way. So Vigor would do one, and the Nichols Brothers would do the top part of it as well. So you could do certain components and then have them shipped to a centralized spot to then put them together and then get them back up to Washington State. That'd be part of the bidding process. Before, we weren't even able to look. That problem was not even on the table because we couldn't even try. Correct. And now it's a little bit different. So what I think might happen, and I don't know, I'm not in the business of building boats, but what our hope was based off of some of the conversations is that you'd build certain components here locally that have a joint venture to build other components elsewhere. We'd be able to get those parts here via train or rail, obviously. And then from there, we'd finally assemble them potentially here.
Great.
Bruce, did that kind of cover the scope of the question you had?
Yeah.
The other one was also because really it's staffing. Staffing is the hard part when it comes to the boats and the schedule and the cancellations. Mm-hmm. And I think folks on Vashon know very well that is a very more complex than you would imagine. When you have federal rules, when you have state rules, we're really beholden to the Coast Guard as well. And also the labor contracts that are associated with the folks who work on the boats make it tough, right? Because candidly, the maritime industry is not just ferries. If you earn your credentials, if you have a certain amount of hours, if you're at a certain level when it comes to the maritime industry, you can get poached pretty easily and go somewhere else. So oftentimes folks who work on our ferry systems, when they get to a certain level, they actually leave for a higher pay. So one thing that we are doing is opening up more training opportunities, making it easier for folks to get on board. Eagle Harbor, we increased the number of slots that are open to have people be able to train faster as well. But largely it's working with our union brothers and sisters to help figure out what that process can look like. Because I think ensuring that we have a healthy pipeline, just because, you know, a lot of the captains are getting older and it takes, I think, 6 to 7 years to get certified to even be able to train to be a captain. So it's a lot of that stuff. A lot of the stuff that we're doing is actually long-term to ensure that there's viability and sustainability within the system itself while we try to shore up some of the immediate term issues as well. We've even tried to look in other places and see if we can poach people. And that's going to be, you know, a collective bargaining situation that we'll have as well.
You know, the airline industry goes through exactly the same problem.
Yeah.
You know, it takes so long to train someone and getting them started and helping with that cost really is a huge, huge effort. So I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Joe, Craig here. It's a pleasure to hear from you again. I had the honor of moderating the Candidates Forum where I first met you.
Obviously, that was a fun night.
That was. It was.
I remember that night.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a good night. But I have to tell you, and congratulations on being the chair of the Senate Environment and Energy and Technology Committee. It's great to hear somebody who is one of our legislatures that's as knowledgeable and articulate as you are. That goes a long way in accomplishing the goals that the people you represent can look forward to. So thank you very much for your efforts in those regards.
I appreciate that, Craig.
I have all kinds of questions, but I'm not going to ask them all. because you obviously do things and are involved in things other than what you're the chair of, the committee.
Yeah.
One has to do with healthcare. Vashon, even though it's in the midst, as you know, of a major metropolitan area, is a bit of a desert when it comes to certain kinds of healthcare, including emergency healthcare. Which is also the case for a lot of rural areas in the state of Washington. They don't have to be on islands. They can be out in eastern Washington, as one example. Is there anything that the legislature is working on to try to help with providing better medical care to these so-called deserts of where we're lacking some of this care?
Yeah, so for Vashon specific, obviously, you know, we help fund potentially a new clinic that hopefully will come online pretty soon through Neighbor Care. I know that we worked around the healthcare district as well. So there's some legwork that's already been started for the infrastructure. What we did do recently was we created a student loan forgiveness program for healthcare workers who work in rural and underserved areas, which Vashon would count. So basically, we'll pay for your education if you want to be able to be a healthcare provider in a rural area as well. And there was a number of bills that I think will benefit Vashon. We'll have to coordinate with some of the providers that are there. But basically, if you're a retired nurse and you want to return back to patient care, that's now a possibility that you can do and get recertified as well, make it easier for them to join a practice. Working on a national licensure compact. So there's basically an agreement between 37 states to allow for certain types of healthcare providers to be able to rotate between them and ensuring that they have access to various jurisdictions as well. And then probably, not necessarily related specifically for Vashon or just rural hospitals, but, making sure that oftentimes the staff get burnt out. It's not a safe environment. They don't feel as if this is a place that they can be. Therefore, there's a lack of workers in that space. Having kind of a healthcare safety standard to mitigate the burnout and improve patient quality as well. So there's a number of things that we've done specifically for Vashon to kind of help with the healthcare situation. And as you know, I've been pretty engaged with some of the folks working in that space to make sure that there's funding associated with it. Vashon is in a unique spot where you're not completely rural. Like some folks do have the ability to go get their medical care not on the island, which then causes some sort of financial imbalances as well. Because oftentimes in rural communities, you kind of have to have folks paying the private insurance and also the Medicaid, Medicare in order to make it all work. And that's not necessarily the case in Vashon. You're in a very unique spot. That's why I've been so engaged in that space to make sure that we're doing as much as we can.
You know, that begs another question, which is sort of, it's kind of a segue. The individuals who work in this industry have a heck of a time not only getting here because of the ferries, but living here because of the costs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about low-income housing and the issues with regards to low-income housing. Is the legislature working on anything specifically in that regard?
Yeah, we probably put more money towards affordable housing in the last year than we have probably ever in Washington State. I think it's one of the major components for us that we're facing right now. And Vashon's in a unique spot where, people don't realize the inequalities that exist on the island. And I've supported the food banks. I've supported the youth and family services. There's a number of people on the island who can't even afford to live on the island, even though they work on the island as well. And that's just not a tenable situation for anybody. Mm-hmm. There's a number of proposals that I've seen already come through for Vashon around affordable housing that we're going to take a look at. Systemically, that pot of money is bigger for Washington State as a whole. So hopefully we can figure out somewhere to get there as well. And then part of it is potentially doing it in a way where you can have more sustainable buildings, being able to use less energy in those buildings as well. I see affordable housing and climate change and all that as being related, right? Because if you don't take care of all those needs for people, we won't be able to have a healthy ecosystem for us to all thrive. So, supporting our most marginalized, underserved communities, having access to affordable housing, having clean energy, all that stuff is all related.
Thank you.
So related to this, I know that that there's a difference in the payment rate from state programs for healthcare based on rural designation or city or whatever it's urban and Vashon, because we are so close to, physically close to other healthcare facilities, we don't qualify for that rural designation. However, in order for us to get to those places, we have to go by ferry, and sometimes you can't get there. So I know that, is there any chance of Vashon being somehow designated a rural area when it comes to healthcare monies that are, I'm trying to think of the program. I'm sorry, I'm blank. It's like a Medicaid program, only it's a state program.
Yeah, I think there's a federal formula that's associated with it. So likely there'll be some sort of advocacy in terms of making sure that that potentially changes. I don't necessarily have control over that type of mechanism. I think it's actually done in a very similar way towards the San Juan and other jurisdictions as well. So it would have to be reviewed more holistically and not necessarily just for Vashon. Right.
Okay.
Joe, I had a question just in terms of the committee, environment, energy, technology. On the technology end, what is Washington State doing with or about AI, artificial intelligence? Yeah. What's going on
there?
That's
going to be a lot. So as you can imagine, there's not many people in the legislature that have a background in technology. I happen to have a background in technology, and I think that's an area where there's a lot of need for regulation, right? AI, first off, has been around for a long time. Generative AI is the new thing that people are kind of scared about just because it has implications to impact our communities in a very robust way. And I think one of the most important things is that, you know, there's a saying when I first came into the legislature, the legislature is set up to solve yesterday's problems tomorrow, right? Like, it's fundamentally very slow. So the biggest thing that we're going to talk about right now in the legislature that we're going to draft policies on is setting a framework in terms of how that can be thoughtfully implemented and regulated. So we won't be able to candidly regulate AI faster than the development of AI just because of the nature of government. But we can do things like say, hey, if this was created by AI, it needs to be disclosed. If there was an algorithm that was being used, it has to be certified by a federal agency that makes sure that there's no bias or something like that. We have to ensure that if it's used to make decisions that might impact somebody's life, there has to be meaningful human review. Things like that, where there are just certain settings where you just can't have like a random algorithm make a determination around somebody's sentencing or somebody's housing or somebody's, you know, benefits, unless there's somebody who is actually double checking. It should be used to help augment and make our lives better. It shouldn't make our lives worse by exacerbating inequities that we have right now. So that's kind of what I'm thinking about in terms of policies. The Biden administration actually put out an AI Bill of Rights. A number of companies, Microsoft, Salesforce, and others, I've talked to them about kind of how they think about it as well. And then also I talked to the ACLU and consumer protection advocates around what that looks like. So there's a whole gambit. There's some folks who just say ban the whole thing because our civilization's at risk. And there's other folks that say, well, actually, this can cure cancer, right? So we don't necessarily want to stop technology that can actually save our lives too. So there's certainly going to be a balance that we need to actually play with and find.
Joe, could you also talk a little bit about education? You know, the McCleary Act, you know, what's going on right now with basic sort of infrastructure of schools. Could you talk a little bit about that? And then also about whether you see charter schools as appropriate for the state education system.
Yeah, so we'll start with the McCleary decision. Right now, the formula by which the funding is allocated is done by a committee that does a robust analysis. That process is kind of undergoing as well. So we'll see what the results are. But agnostic of that, we've made some pretty crucial investments in education as a whole, from early learning, K-12, special skill centers, higher education, and even special education, which I was a big part of as well. A lot of this, first off, by the way, is funded through capital gains. So I was a big fan of progressive revenue. I felt that our budget was lacking the resources to actually invest in our communities like we should. So capital gains is paying for a lot of these investments. So we're talking about $70 million in grants for early learning facilities, which is a dire need in all of our communities, especially Vashon. I don't think that there's many child care providers on Vashon. I've talked to parents that are out there and they'll have to, you know, walk their kids from one house in the afternoon, go to a different house. There's not really one that has space for all day. We've spent another, I think, $600 million for school construction assistance programs. So if there are new schools that need to be built, there's money for that. And then there's also $100 million for small districts and tribal compact schools. And that kind of goes to your point around small school districts. Charter schools count as small school districts. In my personal opinion, I support our public education, and I think that that's the way to go. Before my time, charter schools were allowed. I don't think that there's any new ones. So if there are ones in our communities, I will ensure that those students and those families are successful. I would never or would not advocate for the expansion of charter schools. But if you're in my district, if you are somebody that is in the community, I will make sure that you're successful no matter what. But candidly, I'd prefer public schools, and I prefer investing in public schools. And I think it takes away from those investments when we have other things that may not be as aligned. So that's my general opinion, but obviously that's a very contentious topic in Washington State.
Yeah. Very, very contentious. You mentioned your legislative district. I mean, 34th is an interesting district. I mean, it's West Seattle, it's White Center.
The most Peoria, interesting district, I think.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about how do you balance and how do you juggle? Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of competing interests in the 34th.
Yeah, I mean, I'm busy. I think the biggest thing... Right. So in Washington State, most districts are kind of homogenous. It's either rural, it's urban, it's dense, whatever. Right. With the new redistricting, you know, obviously I have Vashon, I have all of West Seattle. I now have the industrial areas of SoDo, which includes the stadiums. I have Pioneer Square. I have about a quarter of downtown Seattle. I have about half of the waterfront. I also have Georgetown, Highland Park, and South Park as well, which are overburdened communities, some where I grew up, and then parts of Berrien as well. So you have just about every single dynamic in this district that you would in Washington State. So what I ended up doing is I found, you know, as context, in Washington State, we passed, you know, 300 bills last year. 96% were actually bipartisan. So you would be surprised at how much you can get done just by showing up and caring, right? So the way that I deal with a lot of the issues that we see in our communities that I serve everybody is I show up, I listen, and then we try to find problems. And oftentimes they're very non-controversial in terms of how do we get help to folks who need help the most. And for me, that means a lot of meetings. That means a lot of phone calls. I'm here with you guys right now. I do about 4 to 5 meetings in any given day, not to mention visiting schools, not to mention talking to other folks as well. So I just have a very regimented schedule where I try very hard to be proactive around connecting with various parts of the district and ensure that their voices are being heard. Because I think a lot of times people, the ones that you need that need help the most, don't even know that they can get access to help, right? No offense to Vashon. Vashon is very good at emailing their legislators. Not everybody is as good as emailing their legislators. So I will proactively go out to Berrien, to White Center. When SoDo first became part of the district, I literally just had my staff take a look at every major organization or business that's there. And we emailed everybody and just said, hey, I'm your new senator. Just want to introduce myself. Happy to come down and chat. And I did that for a couple of months. And oftentimes folks said that was the first time anybody's ever done that, right? So I went to go visit with the Mariners and help pick up trash around the stadiums and whatnot, just to kind of get a sense of what's going on. So I think a lot of it is just showing up and caring. That goes a long way.
Fantastic. So, Joe, you're 40 years old this year, right?
I'm 39.
Hey, you're 30. Yeah, you will be 40. Oh.
Rub it in.
I don't want to jump the gun here. You're half the age of most of us. So that's
exactly. that's about half a Hallman.
Yeah, yeah, right, exactly. So my real question is, you know, at 40 years old, looking forward the next 10, 20, 30, even 40 years, when you'll be like the other Joe, an 80-year-old, do you see yourself being active politically in the future, near future and far future? What do you see for yourself?
I will serve however the community sees fit, right? And, you know, I've said this before in Vashon and some of the forums and whatnot, political service to me is an honor and it's a privilege. And it was never my intention to hold a public office. It was kind of one of those situations where I felt that our district needed representation that reflected the diversity of the community, and that's why I ran. And if the people here want me to stay, then we'll figure out what that looks like. If there's other opportunities that I can serve, then we'll see as well. But I am in an incredible position where not only do I get to chair the Environment, Energy, and Technology Committee, I'm also one of our budget writers for Washington State. And I also happen to be in leadership. So as context, most members are rank and file, which is a great privilege. I think there's four or five chairs in the Senate. There's only three budget writers, and there's only, you know, four leadership positions in the Senate. I happen to be all three. I think I'm the only person that's all three. So I do deeply respect and value the work that's being done. But we'll see. I don't plan on being a state legislator forever. More so because I believe that we need to have fresh perspectives and different people giving their voices to the system as well. So we'll see. You know, you're not the first person to ask. And I think my answer is kind of vague because I actually don't care about being elected. That's not the goal for me. The goal is the outcomes and the impacts we have in our communities. You know, if the best thing for me was, you know, to be some sort of administrator and just help support leaders, I'd be happy to do that just as much as I'd be the one leading as well. So it just depends on the need of the communities and what's appropriate at that time.
Appreciate that. One final question for me. If you're comfortable, could you share your family story as an immigrant family?
Oh,
as
yeah.
a Vietnamese American? You know, sort of,
yeah, give I think that informs a lot of my work. Yeah, right. So my family were refugees from Vietnam during the war. My father was in the military with the South Vietnamese Navy. And he fought alongside the U.S. And during the war, when Saigon fell, he was evacuated out, like a lot of folks that you see in that film. My mom was back in the village at that time, didn't know if he was alive or dead. And for 3 years, she basically waited to see what was going on. And finally, he was able to get messages back to her in Vietnam, because obviously, as you can tell, the Vietnamese government wasn't going to send letters from the U.S. back to Vietnam. They ended up sending it to Japan and Japan to Vietnam. So she was one of the boat people. So if you look at my office or my social media handles, you'll see this picture of a boat that my family is on. That is the boat that they used to escape Vietnam. So that's the context in which my upbringing to the Seattle area existed. Shortly after they got here, my father was in a car accident that left him quadriplegic. So not a very good situation when you have young kids at home. And because of that, I was basically raised by a single mother who was also trying to take care of my father at the exact same time. And as you can probably imagine, it was not easy by any means. And one of the most vivid memories that I have growing up, and one of the reasons why I served, is my brother and I used to have to carry my father up and down the front steps of our house. That just happens to be where his room was. So whenever we had to go to a doctor's appointment, we'd physically carry him in his whole chair up and down about five steps. One of our neighbors came by one day and said, "Hey, why don't you have a ramp?" And the honest answer was that we just couldn't afford one. So he came by with his buddies that next weekend and built one for us.
Wow.
So when I talk about the 34th district, this is where I was born and raised. So I served because this community gave so much to me and my family, and I want to give back.
Fabulous. It's a great story.
Thank you, Joe, for letting our listeners know your roots, and they run deep here in the 34th. So much appreciated.
Very deep. Yeah,
I will say that let our listeners know your colleagues are scheduled now to join us. You earlier in the year had scheduled on Voice of Vashon, but then a special session came along and disrupted those
plans.
Yeah, tours, so
really, I had to go down to Olympia that day. That was tricky.
Yes, so really glad that that you could rejoin us later here in the summer. But Joe Fitzgibbon is going to be on September 5th, and Emily will be on. And unfortunately, I do not recall that date, but.
Yeah, she's great, by the way. I'm so thankful to have them as members. I mean, I'm biased, obviously, but I think we have the best delegation in all of Washington State. Right? Like, Joe Fitzgibbon has his deep, deep expertise in the legislature. He's the majority leader in the House, like one of the most powerful people in all of Washington State. Emily is just on fire. There's nobody that knows more about affordable housing than she does in all of Washington State, period. And she cares so deeply about our communities. And I'm fortunate to serve with them.
Wonderful. Well, our listeners are definitely going to be looking forward to those opportunities to hear from them. I do say one thing I want to give you the opportunity for folks who do want to follow up with you about the things you've talked about today or any other issues, right, that they would like to share with you. How do they get in touch with you?
Yeah, just send me an email, joe.nguyen@ledge.wa.gov, or, you know, that's probably the best way. My staff takes a look to make sure that I kind of see it as well. feel free to reach out online. I come by to the island about twice a month. And what I usually do is I put out office hours, and it's usually at the Vachon coffee shop down by the art center right there. Mm-hmm. And then I just open up slots, 15 minutes, come by, we'll chat just about everything. So I come by pretty often, and then also send an email as well if you need.
Could you get the email one more time?
Yeah, joe.nguyen@leg.wa.gov.
Got it. Thank you.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
You should probably expect to see me fairly shortly. I'm right after this meeting, we're going to have lunch, and then I'm going to go to a group of folks who's talking about developing a Vachon Mori Climate Action Plan.
So, very cool.
Yeah,
love it.
We might want to schedule some time.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Well, say, before we dive into the last 5 minutes or so of our show, Truman, anything on the indictment watch front?
No, I'm watching. I actually have CNN up here, and the only thing that's popped up in breaking news is that there have been warrants issued on the on that riot that, or the fight that took place on the dock, where the dock worker was moving a pontoon boat, and the big fight started. That's the only thing that's come up.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're in indictment free at the moment. And indeed, Joe, you are certainly welcome to join us in this next topic of discussion. But it's maybe, well, sort of the danger zone.
Exactly.
Let's see. And if there's anything important happening in national news, I expect our listeners want to hear about that the former president indictment count is up. 3 counts now going on 4. And the one thing that I definitely want to spend a little time on, former U.S. Attorney General Bill Barr said, even if he is convicted, meaning the former president, even if he's convicted of both crimes, I don't think he will serve a day in prison. Because, I'm quoting, any Department of Justice would basically cut some kind of deal so we don't have the spectacle of a former president in prison. Craig, you have some legal background.
Yeah, quickly.
What's your thoughts?
My thoughts are I wouldn't believe Bill Barr about it, you know, about the same as how far I could throw him.
Although you are a weightlifter, right?
Yes. And he's come around, you know, a bit. He's changed his tune in the last year. But be that as it may, I'm one of those individuals, and I hate to say I told you so, but I said that the former president was going to be indicted this summer, and that probably be indicted several times. And as you indicate, we're at 3, and we'll probably be at 4, 5, or 6 before the end of fall. In answer to will he serve any time in prison, well, a lot of people, including my co-pilot and Truman, is of the opinion that he won't. And that's a very tenable position. Sure. There are administrative issues as well as political issues there. The Secret Service, so what are you going to do? Put them up in a cell next to him?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Know, that's follow him around in federal prison, although there are federal prisons that he could probably fit in, no pun intended. I suspect that he will be convicted of felonies, and he probably will be placed under some sort of restricted house arrest. He may be limited access to his golden toilets, but he will be. You heard it here. He will be convicted, and he will be limited in terms of his liberty.
Okay, got a couple minutes left. Anybody else want to chime in on that?
Well, I was just going to, you know, my thing is that if it's a federal crime that he's convicted of, that he'll be pardoned, I think.
Who's going to pardon him?
Well, whomever, I don't know.
But the only people that can pardon him is the president.
Exactly, and I could see that happen.
And if he's not elected or Republican, there won't be any.
Yeah, but I could even see Joe Biden pardoning him just so that we don't have the spectacle of that happening. But the benefit of that would be, as a convicted felon, you can no longer hold office. And that would be the benefit for me, just keeping the heck out of any kind of office, you know, mm-hmm. in the future.
We may have to check the details on that.
Exactly.
Sure. Or just, you know, elect the right kind of president.
There you go.
Yeah. Any other comments? Okay, I think we're down to 1 minute, so... will Bill Barr, former attorney general, testify in the Jack Smith trial against the former president?
Yes.
Yes, I agree. Okay.
Yeah.
That was a short answer.
That was a short answer.
Unanimous on that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we are approaching the last 20 seconds of the show. Our guest for the next edition of the Brown Briefly will be Fire Chief Matt Vinci, who will discuss the results of the Vashon fire levy. So we'll look forward to hearing from Matt next week. For this week, for Truman, Bruce, Craig, Senator Joe Wynn, thank you again for joining us. It's been inspirational to hear your views and your service to us as our state legislative senator. I'm Kevin Jones. We'll all see you next week.
See you next week.
Hey, guys.
Bye now.
Talk soon.